Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It's Friday, May 13th, 2022. Today, as we do each week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW senior writer, joins me with his reporting and editorial analysis. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
The wave of book bans and educational gag orders around the country continues to grow. This week, Unite Against Book Bans, an effort to fight back, launched in April by the American Library Association, announced an impressive show of support.
Yeah, and you know, it's been rather demoralizing watching all these book bans and these educational gag orders and other legislation targeting the freedom to read sort of sweep the nation in many states and school districts and library districts around the country. But it's also been pretty uplifting watching how people are stepping up and defending the freedom to read. You know, we've seen it on the local level, where people are showing up to local school and library board meetings, for example, and pushing back against this, you know, vocal but very organized minority that's seeking to pull books from schools and libraries. You know, we've seen it on the national level, where Congressman Jamie Raskin last month held a hearing on the matter before his subcommittee. And we're seeing it now in court, even, where in Lano County, Texas, citizens are suing in federal court, suing their county executives for the censorship activities in their local library. And this week, as you pointed out, the American Library Association announced that more than 25 major organizations, including a host of publishers and author and bookseller groups, have joined its Unite Against Book Bans campaign, which is an effort to help communities defend the freedom to read. Launched in April, the group aims to raise awareness of the threats facing the freedom to read. And, you know, it's, you know, all in response to this surge of book bans and other legislation which are emerging around the country, which we've, you know, talked about extensively on this show. Now, what exactly is this group, Unite Against Book Bans, going to do? I think that's a good question. I don't think we exactly know just yet. I do think, as they say, awareness is a big part of the mission. At the same time, you have to be pretty out of it, pretty out of the loop, at least, not to be aware of what's going on with book bans around the country. But I think the effort can really make a difference in helping people craft their responses and in really reaching policymakers and showing them that, hey, book banning and government meddling is the actual definition of censorship, right? And, you know, hey, your constituents are paying attention. You know, among the groups signing the measure to join with Unite Against Book Bans are, you know, there's numerous library groups, but also the American Booksellers Association, the very powerful American Federation of Teachers, the Authors Guild, and, you know, major publishers, including Macmillan, Penguin Random House, and Simon & Schuster. So a lot of good, I think, can come from that. If you don't know about it, you can check it out on their website, Unite Against Book Bans. You can Google them. You'll come right up. Maybe see how you can join in the defense, because this is a serious issue and a serious threat, and it requires engagement, because the strategy behind this national effort to ban books is pretty shrewd, right? It's basically aimed at taking control of the levers of power at a hyper-local level, right? Now, we see it's being supported by, you know, sort of dark money groups on the national level, but the goal really is to activate people to take over their school and library boards on a local level and then choose what local communities can read and see in libraries and schools, or maybe more to the point, what people can't see and read in their communities. And it's been remarkably effective. And again, I'm going to point this out, awareness alone does not protect your freedom to read against this kind of coordinated political action. Outrage statements don't get the job done. This is one of those things where you have to show up. You have to show up to your school board meeting. You have to show up to your city council meetings. You have to vote. You have to campaign. You have to get involved. You have to run for local office if that's what it takes, or volunteer. I can't stress this enough. Groups like Unite Against Book Bans can help. They can do a lot of good work for us. But defending the freedom to read is really ours to protect. And that means each of us.
This week, a federal judge dealt a setback to indie publisher Chelsea Green and a group of authors, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr., in a First Amendment case against Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, and you know, this is really an interesting case, and one that I think is sort of flying below the radar, and I'll try to explain why I think it's an interesting case. Now, as some of our listeners may recall, the suit revolves around some controversial claims that were repeated in a book published by Chelsea Green called The Truth About COVID-19, Exposing the Great Reset, Lockdowns, Vaccine Passports, and the New Normal by authors Joseph Mercola and Ronnie Cummins, with a foreword by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Now, I say it's controversial because two of the book's authors, Mercola and Kennedy, are sort of infamous, right? You know, both have appeared on this list called the Disinformation Dozen, right? It's been circulating online. It's this list of 12 people that are alleged to be the top spreaders of COVID-19 misinformation. And Mercola actually had the top spot on that list, in fact. And, you know, the New York Times even did a profile of him last year and described him as this internet savvy entrepreneur who's made money off of, you know, pushing this misinformation. He's published over 600 articles on Facebook that seeks to cast doubt on COVID-19 vaccines, for example. So last year, Senator Elizabeth Warren wrote Amazon, noting that she believed the book was perpetuating dangerous conspiracies about COVID-19 and spreading false and misleading information about vaccines. And yet, she observed, whenever her staff went to search on Amazon for COVID-19 and vaccine, this book would pop right up to the top. So Warren asked Amazon to detail how and why Amazon's algorithm was preferencing this book in its search results and, you know, possibly doing something that was unethical and maybe even unlawful. Well, with that, Mercola, Cummins, Kennedy, and Chelsea Green sued. They argued that a 60-year-old Supreme Court precedent in a case called Bantam Books versus Sullivan established that state officials were in violation of the First Amendment when they sent letters to booksellers warning that selling certain books was potentially illegal. They asked the court for damages, for a declaratory judgment, and for a preliminary injunction ordering Warren to retract her letter publicly. Well, this week, the judge denied that injunction. The case still lives, but the injunction is now dead. And in denying that injunction, federal judge Barbara Rothstein eviscerated the plaintiff's claims. And she held that they were unlikely to succeed in establishing Warren's letter was a prior restraint on free speech. And that's because the court held Warren really didn't have any power over Amazon, right? She was not, when she wrote this letter, wielding state regulatory power. Now, in the Supreme Court case Bantam Books, the court observed, the commission was sending letters with an express mandate from a state legislature that had passed a statute criminalizing obscenity. Warren, on the other hand, had no basis for her statement that Amazon's practices were potentially all unlawful. Put another way, the judge reasoned, you know, her threat of illegality or potential legal sanctions were just non-existent, right? Legal sanctions can act as an unlawful restraint on free speech, the court ruled, but it's a threat that can only be perceived if there's actually a law in place, if there's a realistic chance that, you know, the threat can be actually carried out. Now, the lawsuit continues, as I said, but that's a death blow to the case, in my opinion. And I think this ruling, too, is an important reminder to those of us standing up to book bans that, hey, the law is, in fact, on our side.
So how does an admittedly narrow dispute over a controversial book about vaccines tie to the book bans?
So that's true. This is, you know, it's a narrow case. Some people might see this as being about, you know, what's going on with this book over COVID-19 vaccines and people spreading alternative facts, for example. But I think it's also a reminder that the laws we have on the books and the Supreme Court precedents backing those laws up really do protect the freedom to read, including the case at issue here, the Bantam Books decision. Because what we're seeing in many states are these new local laws that are basically obscenity laws, right? In Texas, for example, Governor Greg Abbott has proposed this parental bill of rights law, and legislators are, you know, sending letters, you know, asking questions about specific titles. And I think what the Warren case, with this case against Elizabeth Warren reminds us, as Judge Rothstein writes, that the threat of legal sanctions can act as an unlawful restraint on free speech. So, for example, some have proposed and some districts have passed laws banning the teaching of so-called critical race theory. Now, you're a teacher and you get a letter asking you to answer for your illegal conduct and telling your students about the 1619 Project. What Rothstein has reminded us in her decision, I think, is that that would pretty clearly run afoul of the Constitution.
And finally this week, Andrew, the Association of American Publishers held its annual meeting. Coming off 2 years of record-shattering sales growth, the program nevertheless focused more on the challenges that lie ahead.
Yeah, so you can read all about the AAP's annual meeting on the PW site. I was not there. My boss, Jim Milliot, was there, and he wrote the piece. But, you know, yeah, I read the coverage, and, like, look, we've talked a lot about the challenges facing the industry in terms of supply chain disruptions and paper shortages, but you know, a lot of the program really did focus on the challenges facing publishing, coming off a year that was absolutely sensational, 2 years really that have been sensational in terms of sales. It struck me in some respects that this was sort of like the industry's American Carnage speech, right? It was like, wow, there's a lot going on here. You know, AAP President Michael Peach spoke of, for example, sensational and outrageous book bans, an unprovoked war in Ukraine, unprecedented supply chain disruptions, and a persistent shortfall, in his words, in diversity in our offices and publishing programs. He also cited climate change and unrelenting efforts to weaken the copyright framework that the publishers depend on from big tech. These are claims that AAP President Maria Pallante spoke about as well. So you can read that piece on the PW site, but I also just want to close out with something which many of our listeners have likely seen on social media, and that's the AAP's decision to give its Distinguished Public Service Award to North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis. Now, it's drawn a lot of attention and a lot of scrutiny. Now, look, I understand that Tom Tillis serves a key role on the judiciary, and he carries the publishing industry's water on copyright. But Tillis last year also co-sponsored a bill that would prohibit the use of federal funds to teach the 1619 Project in K-12 schools and school districts. And on his website, he said that he sponsored that bill because Americans don't want their tax dollars going towards promoting, quote, radical ideologies meant to divide us. And that's deeply disconcerting. You know, at a time when book bans and censorship are paramount, which the AAP called out in its program, and at a time when diversity in our professional ranks and on our bookshelves is something the publishers say they are deeply concerned with, again, something the AAP called out in its program, you know, how do you get to Tom Tillis, who's sponsoring this bill to take down the 1619 Project, right? In a statement, the AAP said that, look, we give the award to Democrats and Republicans, and that's true. But look, this is my personal opinion here. That's not an explanation of how you get to giving this award to Tillis, as much as it is an admission that this award is really just transactional. And I think if you look at the online reaction, it reflects the view that many of us in the publishing community think that we shouldn't ever have to compromise on any of our core values in pursuit of a policy aim.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks for joining me on the program today.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on the next podcast from CCC, a peer-reviewed article published this month in PLOS ONE has examined what happens in the scientific record when journal-published versions of articles are retracted in cases of research previously available on preprint servers. Michelle Avisser-Whiting, editor-in-chief of Research Square, a leading preprint provider, found a reassuringly small number of such retractions, but she worries that inconsistencies in publisher responses poses a threat to the scholarly record and to scientific integrity.
Look, retractions are still a contentious thing. I think some of the best work being done in the area of scientific integrity is the work to destigmatize the retraction and not just normalize it, but reward, you know, the admission of fault and the active correction of the record by authors. And the more we can do in this area, I think the more we'll see that, you know, authors taking responsibility.
Preprints, retractions, and the scientific record. Coming up on the next CCC podcast. Our producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts. And please do follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening to this Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.